I was like, I want to sound like the harp. I wanted to sound like Robert Plant.
Yeah.
And he said, well, we need this, this, and this. And
okay, Joe, wait, start that story over here because we're just going to start in. Okay. So Andy Johns, you're talking about.
Yeah, so he's engineering the third iteration of the Extremist album. That was started with me and John Cuniberti at Bearsville and then moved to San Francisco to Alpha and Omega. And then finally, year and a half later, with Andy Johns. And we were doing the overdub sessions at Record One. We'd cut with Greg and Matt Bissonette. We'd cut the basics at Ocean Way in the big room. Beautiful place. So we're at Record One and we're talking about the Extremists. And I said, look, I want two harp solos. It's got to sound like Robert Plant on When the Levee Breaks, you know? And then Andy's like, well, I know how to do that. We just need this, this, and this. Let's just call someone and get it. Half hour later, we had the stuff. Andy Browers was just around the corner, right? So, and all of a sudden I start playing the harp and it was like, whoa. I felt like Robert Plant there for a second. And that's how we captured it. And yeah, he had great stories about the drum sound and using the Benson and the tape echo and the compression on either side and just fascinating.
Those recordings, I mean, the fact that he and his brother Glenn came up with those techniques and, you know.
But that's they're so different. I made records with both brothers.
The two of them are so different.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, so it's really remarkable how they manage sessions entirely different. One is straight ahead, the other was kind of like Spinal Tap, just, you know, both brilliant, but you had to be ready.
So Andy was more like Spinal Tap.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. In a loving way.
Glenn is more serious.
Totally serious.
Mm-hmm.
They both possessed an innate physical ability to know if music was right, if it was being played at the right tempo, the right pitch, the right key. What was a good take? What was a bad take? I'd say Glenn knew how to manage people really well, and Andy didn't. It was Andy's world, and you were in it while he let you be in it. And so you had to strap in and just get ready.
Did you purposely, really because of those records, though, those that he worked on? I mean, Zeppelin IV is,
And all the way up to Van Halen, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's what I was looking for.
Yeah.
Something remarkably different. I didn't think he would actually take on a project like mine. And it was my manager, Mick Brigden, who brought it up. And I said, well, if you can get him on the phone, maybe I can convince him, you know. Actually, it was at Eddie's studio that I played him some dats of the demos and what we had already recorded at Bearsville in San Francisco. And he wanted to do it. I don't know why, but maybe he thought it was a challenge to do an instrumental record.
Have you worked with Eddie Kramer?
Never. I always wanted to.
Yeah.
Every time I meet up with him, we're always talking like, why aren't we not doing something together, you know? So, you have.
Yeah, I did the Alcatraz record with him.
Oh, great.
Incredible.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah. I was kind of a punk back then, you know, and wanted to control a lot of things.
Still.
Still.
Still a punk.
Still a punk. But it was great working with him because he's very earthy, and he would take like a piece of gear and just crank it until it was, you know, screaming for mercy, you know, and great instincts, great live rock and roll capturing moment instincts. And that's what was really helpful for me, because before that it was, you know, kind of all over the place.
How did you guys change the way you captured your guitar sounds from the 80s to now, for example? Is there anything different that you've gotten from people that you've worked with that you say, oh, I like to do this now? Do you guys record DIs all the time with your guitar sounds now if you want to?
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
Yeah, I do now. That sort of came a little later, you know, where that became more common. But the miking technique that I use, I learned from Eddie Kramer.
Okay.
And it's three mics. It's usually a 57, 421, and like a Beyer 150.
Okay.
One of the great things about working with him was I learned how, you know, vital it is to get the microphone where you need it. Because before that, you know, I was recording in my bedroom on a, you know, just a little condenser mic. But and he would, he'd run things sometimes through a slap echo, you know, with the two-track machine. And I've got a great story. There was this one song called Desert Diamond, and the solo section, I had this idea. And the idea was I was going to write, and I was explaining this to Eddie, I'm going to write the guitar solo out, and then I'm going to orchestrated for 15 guitars. I'm going to write the melody, and then I'm going to write it out backwards, and I'm going to record this whole thing backwards and then fly it down to two tracks and then fly it in. And he's like, no, you're not. And I'm thinking, okay, I actually started to, this is a great story. I actually started to sneak into the studio at night. Like I'd get there at like 2 a.m. when nobody was around. And I started to record this and it took me like 4 days. And I got all these total beautiful orchestra of guitars in reverse, and I fly it into this two track. And the next day, the next night, I was gonna sneak in and fly it into the master. And I take my tape and I put it on the shelf. And as I'm leaving the studio, Bob Dylan is sitting in the waiting room. He's waiting to get in. Because when Bob would get an idea, it didn't matter what time it was or anything, you know, you had to be ready, you had to get him into the studio, and then he would sit in the room and he would just play. So, and he liked slap echo. So uh-oh. What happened was, when you make slap echo from a piece of two-track, you run the tape, you record it on the record head, and it gets played back on the repro head, but you have to change the pitch, the speed of the tape. So the tape's running, you know, a little slower, and you get this slap back, and you only record on one channel of the two channels. So I guess they needed a piece of tape. And there's my beautiful stereo guitar backwards orchestra. And they grab it and they're using that for slap for Bob Dylan. And I get in there the next day, that night, and I sneak in the studio. And I'm going to take the tape and I'm going to fly it in. Half of it is half of my backwards guitar orchestra. And the rest, because I had to bring it back to speed, is a munchkin Bob Dylan just going, hey. Oh, and I still have that tape someplace.
That is amazing.
The stories of tape, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, the world, yeah.
I'd like to take a second to talk to you about this channel. Believe it or not, 57% of the people that watch here regularly are not subscribed. So I would encourage you to hit the subscribe button now. This will help me get even more of my dream guests in the future. Thank you.
When did you guys stop using tape?
There was a transition. It would have been in
late 90s.
Late 96, 97. We were doing Crystal Planet, and we were recording as a live trio to tape. And then we would pick all the best takes, put it into Pro Tools, and do the comping in Pro Tools, and then put it back to tape and mix from the tape. So that was the last album where I think tape was involved in capturing the band playing. And then it was, digital. We tried a couple of records, mixing in the box, and didn't really like it. I think we did digital tape. We did, what was it? Was it the Mitsubishi? Was it Sony that
the
came
Sony,
out?
The Sony 3348.
That was the first one. Then there was the Atari.
I think we did a live album that was on that. It could have been even prior to that. When did that machine come out? Mid-90s?
No, it was earlier.
It was in the 80s, I think.
So then 80s. That means that the Time Machine Live was done on those machines. And then I think we transferred them. I don't know why.
Bob, when I talked to Bob Clearmountain, he said that he would transfer it over to the to those machines. Instead of locking up, a lot of mix engineers started doing this in the 90s. They transfer the 48 track analog to the 48 track digital, so you wouldn't have to have the tracks sync up.
Yeah.
And they would mix off that. Chris Lord-Alge did that. Bob Clearmountain did that. A lot of people, Brendan O'Brien, they would mix off those machines. It made it a lot easier to do.
It was digital tape at first.
Yeah.
And I remember because Frank Zappa got the Sony and he transferred his entire catalog to it. And I just wasn't really quite convinced, you know, of the sound. I was kind of like a little stubborn about the whole digital thing. And I actually bought one of the Atari machines, 32-track digital, and I never used it because I had a little equipment rental company.
Okay.
And I put it in there, and it did great because everybody wanted it. But there was just something about it. And then when it transitioned into, digital, like a computer, I was a little resistant. You know, I actually purchased the second to last Studer 24-track machine that they made. Alan Sides purchased the last one. And I had this incredible 3M. And there was something about that machine that really, it had this beautiful hump at mid-range, in the mid-range. And the first time I recorded a record in the box was Real Illusions. Mm-hmm. And I regret it because I didn't understand how the digital stereo bus at that time, because all of the technology has evolved and the components are so much, the trans converters are so much better now.
So much better.
But yeah. one of the biggest shockers for me was the sound difference that I discovered from mixing in the box and coming out of the box and coming up into a warm console with all the stuff. But once you get into that digital editing realm, there's no turning back.
Yeah, so how has that changed? Had Pro Tools back in the 80s, would the records have gone faster? Yes, right? Ooh, or no?
Maybe no.
Would they be
that
different?
That's a good question.
Would they be different? How different would they be?
Well, what I noticed right away was when there was a digital interface of your music, of your sound waves, it reminded me of being in Bill Westcott's class.
Yeah.
And looking at orchestration paper. You see the whole thing and it goes from left to right.
Yeah.
That's how we were taught to think about music. Yeah. We were all of theory, everything, figured bass, choral music, cantatas, symphonies. We were all taught by Bill on the orchestration paper. And so I started with Logic and then moved to Pro Tools. And I thought, well, this is great. This is just like I'm a kid in high school again and I can see everything and where it's going. The sound part, you know, I was never much of an engineer. I wasn't as interested when I was writing a song with what it was going to sound like. I was more interested with the notes and the harmony and everything. So that's why I loved it. Maybe because I had all those choices and there was no destructive editing that it took longer. I'm not sure.
I would agree that it was... With analog, you push the button, there you have it, you're done. You know, and with the digital, it seems like it would go much quicker. But when you have all those options to tweak and edit, another whole creative, you know, part of the brain opens up and you can get lost. It's like a den of iniquity.
yeah. And sometimes we were talking about tape before, and that your story about the Dylan and the tape, it reminded me of, we were doing the Lords of Karma for the surfing record, and it came in the morning to High Street Studios, and there's a box sitting in front of the couch filled with this garbage and some recording tape. And I said, what's that? And he goes, that's Lords of Karma.
Those are the tape edits.
It was because we were doing a tape edit, and we were trying to do that. We couldn't, because we needed one other person to mix the breakdown. We decided to cut the tape and mix it separately. So the rest of the song was on the coat rack, and there was a note that said, do not touch, and the cleaner doesn't read English. And we hadn't thought about that. So they saw this mess on the coat rack, and they just dumped it. And John was able to find it in the dumpster in the alleyway behind.
Oh, my God.
And we had to clean it and we put it back on because we couldn't afford to like recut anything.
Right.
Yeah. Wow. So that's what wound up on the record was this.
That's
anyway,
great.
So had it been digital, we would have had backups that would have been on the cloud, whatever. You know, there would have been no destructive funny bits. And I think we lost like a hemi, demi, semiquaver somewhere in there with the razor blade. Yeah. The song kind of, boop, it kind of gets a bit peppy there right after the breakdown.
It's hard to believe that razor blades and things like that were used in recording to cut.
Oh, yeah. I remember the first time, I was always fascinated with the engineering process. You know, I loved the idea of getting in there and seeing what EQ can do and all this, but I didn't quite understand editing because I never had an experience, and I was with Frank, and I had just started working with Frank, and I was in the studio, and I was watching him, and he mixed this one section of a song, and then he stopped the tape. I'm thinking, what is he doing, you know? And then he makes some changes, and he mixes another part, and I'm watching him, and he gets up, and he goes to the two-track machine, and he slews it, and I'm going, oh, wow, there's... Yeah, I see. That's the kick drum, you know? And then he marks the tape. And I'm thinking, what is he doing? And he takes the tape off and he puts it on the block and he cuts it, which you would think is completely taboo. You know, I'm like, what is he doing? And then he takes the other one, cuts it, glues it together. And I'm trying to, it didn't dawn on me what was happening. And I'm sitting there watching, and he rewinds it and plays it. And as the edit goes by, it all came to me. And I had this complete epiphany of what the editing process was, what you can do. And it was like magic. And I was stunned. It goes over the head, and I just went, oh. And I look at her, and Frank looks at me, and I was just like, you. And he goes like this. He goes, yep, it makes every day like Christmas. And he gave me a little edit block, and I just started editing, tape recording everything, television commercials. The whole room was filled with little pieces of tape, and then you cut them together, and it was just so much fun.
That's so creative to do that. Yeah. And it's something that you can physically touch, right? You've got these pieces of tape, you put them together, as opposed to something that's digital that's more esoteric because you're combining numbers, really. You know, we work on guitars, you play guitars and everything. Now the amp is you can either play with an amp or you can use digital amps nowadays and things like that. And
maybe but you can't crossfade tapes, you can't you know, when you're cutting tapes, there's the options for editing are just so gigantic compared to tape.
It is really nice, though, the feeling, maybe it's not anxiety, but I'm going to use the word anxiety of cutting a 2-inch tape, piece of tape.
Committing.
Committing to a performance, saying, you know, and we were talking about the extremist. After the guitar solo, there's a break. The rest of the song is from the night before. And that was, you know, we would think that was crazy.
Time travel.
Yeah, wouldn't work, you know.
Yeah.
But once Andy did the edit and we listened to it, we thought, well, that's genius. We did play that part better last night for some reason.
Yeah.
And it just, the feeling of it made the song more interesting as it went along. But the commitment. Andy was king of that. Cut everything up. Yeah. I think we had 80 to 100 reels of tape for the Extremist album.
Wow.
It was insane. And he had it like in his brain, you know, he'd be calling out numbers. Give me 44. Where's 44? I want it right now, you know.
Oh, man.
Having a drink.
Yeah.
Coming up there.
Yeah.
Even be looking. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, where's the razor blade? You know, that kind of thing. Cigarette smoke.
Oh, my God. He cut so many pieces of tape over his lifetime.
Yeah.
He was doing. There was a guy that worked at Capitol Records in the basement, and he edited forever. And I went down there. And this guy would cut the tape on the fly with a pair of scissors. I watched him do it because I had just made Flexible. And if you watch the master tape of Flexible, by to edit, because I only had 8 tracks.
Yeah.
So I'd have to mix little tiny pieces and cut them in. And I'm watching this guy and I'm saying, that's and he's been doing it for so long, the tape's going by. Just like that. And he got a pair of scissors and he did it to 2 pieces of tape and cut them together.
Oh my God.
It was like a miracle. I couldn't believe.
Yeah.
He was there for 35 years.
Wow. He's doing something right.
So you guys are out playing together right now. And did you ever think back when you first met that in 2024, that you guys are going to be out touring together? I mean, does that ever just kind of blow your mind?
The idea of 2024 in 1972 was like a million years. I don't think.
Did you even think of the 2000s back then?
No.
Right? You can't even imagine that, right?
No. I mean, the teenage brain is for a guy is a work in progress.
That's for sure.
I think I can speak for myself and say I had faith, complete faith, that we were going to be superstars, rock stars, musicians. We were going to be playing amazing guitar and nothing was going to stop us. I didn't know any of the details, had no idea of the hurdles, the problems, but I didn't think about it. I just was driven, and it was obvious when Steve came for lessons that there was no stopping him either. That's probably why we sort of synced up and became sort of brothers at that time, because unspoken recognition that it's going to happen and we're just going to work as hard as we can every day to make it happen. But 2024.
Yeah, it's so interesting you put it that way when you first mentioned it, because it actually rings a bell in the, we have no idea of the future. don't know what's going to happen, but this is it. When you say that, I instinctually felt at that time, yeah, no, this is happening. Yeah. Game on. And we're going there.
Yeah.
I don't know. I never verbalized it because it would sound crazy and pretentious. And,
yeah.
But something said, this is it for you, for your life. This is what you love. This is what you're going to do. You don't know where it's going to go, but I knew that something was brewing.
What are the chances that you are from the same, that you...
I'm still trying to figure that
out. What are the chances? I mean, yeah. Seriously.
It's kind of crazy.
Yeah. Right?
It is. It's crazy. It is really crazy.
Joe, did you make him learn all the names of the notes on the neck?
Yes.
His first lesson?
Yes.
Absolutely. I have my lesson. I remember because I came in. I tell this story. We're hearing the same stories over and over. But I never really felt, for various reasons, that I had any decent kind of retention or real intelligence, because I was very average as a student or anything.
Mm-hmm.
So I had this block against against memorizing things, you know, and so I can't do that, you know. So during one of my first lessons with Joe, he was very strict and about being prepared.
Mm-hmm.
This was a great training, you know. He said, I want you to come back next week and I want you to learn all the notes on the neck. You have to have every note on the neck memorized. And I'm like, okay. And I remember leaving thinking, I'm not going to do that. I can't do that. What are all those notes?
Is that how he was, Joe?
Yes.
But I go back to my lesson the next week and yeah. Joe says, okay, play an F sharp on the B string. And I go, and he goes, stop. Go home. And don't come back until you know all the notes on the neck. And he wrote, I have it. It says, if you don't know your notes, you don't know SH space, space, exclamation mark. And that was one of the most important lessons I had ever received in my whole life. Because walking home from his house that day, and I don't know if you remember, as I'm walking out, your mom came and said, really? How was the lesson?
Oh.
And Joe said two things that had a remarkable impact on me. He said, my best student is losing his brain. And I thought, best student, because we all loved Joe. We all were taking lessons, losing his brain. And then I remember that walk home. And that was one of the most pivotal moments in my life, because I aligned completely with planted the internal seed, you will never not know your lesson solidly. And that was it. From that day, it actually gave me a sense of... you know, dignity.
Yeah.
It was the discipline that I needed to pull me out of this dark cloud of belief about myself. I know that sounds kind of esoteric, but it was true.
No.
It changed everything.
So I have to ask, Joe, what did you charge for lessons back then? Has anyone ever asked that?
Because yeah.
I always thought there was like, okay, when Steve was taking lessons, what did guitar teachers get back then?
Well, was it $5 an hour?
$5.
And he started out with his friend, Frank Strassel.
Yeah, because I couldn't afford the $5.
Yeah, so they would, you know, split the charge. And then, but after 3 weeks, it was obvious that he needed his own lessons. He was just racing, just learning everything. But in my defense, I don't remember all these harsh moments, but I probably picked it up from the fact that my mother was a school teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And she was a sweetheart, but she knew how to discipline, and she taught kids, so she had to, you know, herd the cats as well as civilize them and teach them. And my father was a genius, so I felt this pressure to step up. Like, if I'm going to teach kids, at least I'll emulate my parents and how they tried to get me to be civilized and how they tried to teach me, you know.
This is an important thing, because I rarely interview people or have conversations with people that are actually really schooled, that know how to read music and things like that. Can you each speak about that a little bit?
I think you need to understand your instrument as deep as you need to, mm-hmm. to get your particular uniquely creative point across. You know, like Bob Dylan doesn't need Steve Vai's technique.
No.
You know? No. So that's really an individual choice. But the funny thing that I recognize is there is a lot, and I'm sure you see it, there is a lot of concern and in youngsters about how much they should know. What should I know? And really, it's not that you should or shouldn't learn music theory. You either will or you won't.
Wow.
Because it's a personal desire. You have to have, I know for me, there has to be a real interest in order for there to be any retention. And for some reason, I had a deep interest. I wanted to learn all the building blocks. I wanted to know the theory. I wanted to know everything. And Joe mentioned Bill Westcott. Mm-hmm. He was a high school music teacher. And he had this incredible class. He was like this savant. And he really laid it on. I mean, he taught us all those things. Yeah. And I was composing. I started taking the class in seventh grade. I made a bargain with the school. They needed a tuba player in the orchestra. And they asked me, and I said, well, I'll play tuba if you let me take this class. And through my whole high school, I had Bill. And for me, because it was very interesting,
yeah,
I learned it quickly. And I retained it, and I still compose and using all that information. As far as the guitar, I wasn't applying it.
Mm-hmm.
I knew the blues scale, you know? But Joe was also taking those classes. He was a little older, you know, in high school. And he was showing me during my lessons how to apply that information on the guitar. Like, this is what the voicing means. This is why this scale works
with it.
Yeah, because I knew all the scales. I knew all the everything, but the fretboard wasn't open. Yeah, so I always say, if it's interesting to you, you'll find yourself learning it, what's necessary for you. But having said that, there's basics that would behoove you to learn.
I tried to make the analogy when I was teaching you know, writing or cooking or if you're a carpenter, you know, like if you're an apprentice carpenter and you're supposed to make a particular thing, do you want to know all the tools necessary to make that piece of furniture, let's say, or properly do a door jam or something? You'd need to know that, because if you just go, you know, screwdriver, wrench, you know, you're not going to get very far. If you're a chef and all you know is sweet and savory, you're not going to get very far. If you're a poet, forget about it,
yeah.
You know? It's all about expression, so the vocabulary. What I noticed right away in teaching, even when I was really young, is that when you say, these are the rules, you use that word rule, already doors are closing inside the student's mind.
Mm.
So I started to say, there are no rules, it's just cause and effect. You play this note, you might get this reaction. If you're looking for a different reaction, then you might want to play a different note. Which one are you going to play? How do you know which note is the sad note, the kind of sad note, the melancholy, like happy, but a little sad, happy, but, you know, not ecstatic, super happy, you know, out of your mind happy, losing your mind, I'm going to explode happy. What are those notes? What are those scales? What are those chords?
And those notes exist.
They exist.
Yeah, they
it's
do.
All in context.
Yes.
When we were doing this thing at your camp, and we started out this thing, and the question is always the same. Joe, do I need to learn this? You know, right away, you know, this person's lazy. You know, they've asked, they are looking for an excuse not to learn, you know, not to study. They want to spend any time. So I said, okay, Steve's going to play this beautiful chord right now. And you played a really nice E chord. And I just played an F on the 13th fret on the E string. And I went, that was horrible, wasn't it? What did everybody feel? That's a thing. Now, what if I played a right note that you think is a right note for the moment, and suddenly it's totally different? And that was the example. Mm. And the other thing was the story I love to tell, which is you're writing music for a scene in a movie, and it's a baby walking towards you. First steps.
Mm.
And everything's, and you're supposed to write some beautiful music. And then the director says, no, we've recut the scene. This time the baby's walking towards you, first steps, kitchen knife, blood all over the baby. Now you're gonna pick a different set of chords, right?
It's just you go for your demolished chord.
That's all it is. It's just cause and effect. Mm-hmm. You want people to get up and dance? You say, "Come on, everybody, get up and dance." You don't say, "Sit down, everybody. Don't get up." And music is the same way. You have to learn how to play the scale. So there's going to be some technical stuff you got to do, but you just have to listen to it. You don't have to play it fast. But you do have to understand when do I use Lydian to evoke that feeling that I want people to feel? And why not minor, harmonic minor, oriental scale, you know? So you have to, how are you going to learn that?
Did you guys consciously try to develop, and because you really developed styles like the first time, did you ever think like, I got to come up with something new for this record because no one's done this before?
You know, when I think back, you know, I would imagine that like Wes Montgomery felt the same pressure because there were so many amazing guitar players before him. And so Hendrix must have felt the same way when he heard Wes Montgomery around. He was a contemporary.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so Jeff Beck obviously did because he just kept going forward and just changing direction, didn't listen to anybody, and just kept breaking barriers and building new bridges. So I think it's, for me anyway, it's better just not to even engage in that. And just continually just be expressive about how you feel about life and what's happening. And, you know, the world does not owe me a career. So I don't get upset when I, you know, when it dips. But I celebrate when it doesn't.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think inevitably, whenever a person decides to play an instrument and they start getting deep into it, their unique sensibilities just have to flow in somehow, unless they really fight it. Mm-hmm. And some people do. And it's basically out of fear of not being able to fit in because what they're doing just might seem too obtuse to them or something and the rest of the world. And then there's people that love playing and they don't really want to have their own voice. They just want to play. When I reflect on me, and how my kind of voice developed, it was very innocent. You know, I didn't feel like, okay, now you remember you're going to be a big rock star guitar player one day, so you have to be different. No, it was just the fun of discovering something that was not what I was hearing usually. Because I would listen to the blues, loved great blues, great rock, great jazz, classical, and I would tinker about with all that stuff. But I never felt good enough to be authentic at any of those things. I mean, if you hear me play the blues, you know, it's, and I tried, and every time I would do something that sounded conventional, and even the really good stuff, it didn't feel right. It never sounded as good as the guys that did it great. And it just felt weird to me. So I found myself just looking for, you know, obtuse things, you know, and once I'd find them, I would just exaggerate them, you know, just, okay, what is that? And how can I, you know, make it bigger? And this never ends. This is a fantastic, it's one of the highlights of playing an instrument like a guitar that is so malleable and changes with every touch, every angle of the pick and every amp and everything. You know, there's so much, there's infinite options. So I also feel that there will be, and there is, young people coming along that are doing that same thing. I mean, you have them all. I mean, you've, Mateo, you know, you see the Tims, Tim Hensons and Scotty LePages. There is a very healthy evolution going on. And I think they're doing the same kind of thing. They're looking for what feels natural to them and then exaggerating it. But I do love when I come across something that I feel is relatively unique. Like, oh, you never played that before. And I haven't really heard that before. You know, let's unpack it. You know, that's fun. It's just fun. You know that.
Oh, yeah.
That's one of the great joys of playing is the discovery of things within yourself you didn't know were there.
So if I said to you, what is a perfect guitar solo from one of your guitar heroes, just anybody that you grew up listening to that you think, oh, this is a perfect guitar solo?
God, so many.
Yeah, there's so many.
Oh, Hendrix, Machine Gun.
Yeah, that's exactly mind. Right,
that's the greatest performance ever on an electric guitar. That's hands down.
It's the voice of God.
I'd have to mention a favorite of mine is Alan Holdsworth, Red Alert from Believe It. To me, that's, you could write a thesis on that, just how he starts, where he goes with it, how bizarre it gets, and then how he ends it. I mean, how he finishes it is so elegant. It's so beautiful.
Yeah.
and you can't hear the pick.
I mean, you can't hear the pick.
I remember watching him like this close, and I see that he's picking, but why can't I hear him?
No, you guys both knew Alan, right?
Yeah.
And
I released his records.
Yes, you did. That's right. So I've saw Alan play many times, but up close, I could never tell what he was doing, ever. I could never see where his fingers were. Yeah. And I could never hear his pick.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Even if you heard Alan play, if you were next to him, is it the same thing?
Oh, yeah. I used to go to his apartment all the time, and he'd be playing, and this same thing. I had this really great gig when I first moved out to California, and I was working for Frank transcribing. I was transcribing some other things, and I got a call from Alan. And I was just this, you know. And he has this very unique way, or he had this unique way of writing down his music. Totally different.
Right.
And he wanted to do a chord book.
Yeah.
But he didn't, he needed a translator. So I was actually hired to go and hang with him and get a great explanation of how he figured how he navigated the neck and the pictures that he saw.
Okay.
And how to translate that into conventional notation so other people can, you know, do what they will with it. It was really a great experience.
I've seen some of his chord charts in the way that he explained them, and they're just very, so fascinating.
Yeah, very abstract, but he knew what he how to kind of capture that stuff in his mind and see it on the guitar. And he improvised everything. It was all improvising. Yeah. That's Freakazoid stuff.
So, what do you guys when you are out touring? Like this, do you tend to practice or do you work anything out before, like, during the tour when you're actually out traveling and do stuff? Do you only pick up the guitar at soundcheck or when you come on the gig when you're touring?
Well, this tour is kind of unique because of what Steve and I have coming after Words Right. So we're woodshedding for an upcoming tour. That's kind of weird for us.
Yeah.
But in general, if I have a day off, I won't play.
Okay.
And most of the time, we play six nights a week, so it's a nice rest. I like playing an hour to 45 minutes beforehand. On this tour, I start warming up around Little Pretty. And so I start with my whole tone scale.
It's a good scale to play over.
It is. It's just it's a good one to warm up with. And so that's my routine. And I basically just go over all the stupid things I did the night before and go, why did you do that? And then try to figure out an easier way to finger something. And a lot of it has to do with the entertainment part of it, where you realize you need to run over there and do something, but you also have to play this part. Our instrumental gigs are rather unique. So we can't just hit a note and jump around and, you know, we're never backing up somebody. You know what I mean? Yeah. We're always at the forefront. So there's a lot of stuff to go over. At the end of a gig, you go, this was good. This was good. Screwed that up. I should work on that one. Maybe try a different pickup. Don't step on the pedal for this. And, you know, so I go through all that.
Do you take notes or you just make mental notes of it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about you, Steve?
Well, through the years, whenever Joe and I would play together, whether it was a G3 jam or a club jam, we'd know what song we were gonna play, and we'd learn it separately, and then occasionally we'd have sound checks for it. But through G3, we'd always have a little production rehearsal. And this tour was very similar, except now we have a new song that we recorded together, and that's really exciting, you know. And we really didn't even need to work on it very much as far as rehearsing it, you know, because you get prepared and then you come in, and it was so glorious to finally like play those melodies, like to go deep. And this tour, for some reason, we are having just the richest and the deepest jams.
Yeah.
You know, it's like now we're in our 60s, you know, and all the years of fun and great and having multiple guitar players on the stage, which was great, but this is not that. You know, this is like, I forget there's an audience, you know, I'm just listening. It was like when we were kids again, Because really, it was about 4 or 5 years I took lessons on and off because Joe was moving to Japan for a while. And then, you know, but the lessons, you know, a lot of times turned into just these glorified jam sessions where we'd sit back to back. I remember once, at least, I know we used to go in the backyard under the tree that had the wind in it.
Yeah.
And just back to back. And with these kids, I was like 13, 14, you know. And it was all about listening, because we didn't see each other.
Right.
I highly recommend this to any guitar player, because it's a different way of communicating. And I have never really had that since. Sure, little tastes here and there. But when you sit for somebody for 4, 5, 6 hours and you all you have is your ear and an occasional giggle, right? Yeah. And that's kind of what we're doing now again. And it's so wonderful. It's real expression.
Yeah. What do you guys have coming up now over the next couple months?
Well, the release of the single is imminent, right? Yep. Or it has happened as we time travel back and forth. The song is about this place on the school grounds where we went, Carr Place High School, the middle school, Rushmore and Cherry Lane, the kindergarten where we all attended. And the place where we used to hang out very late at night after all sorts of trouble and let all of our emotions out and share our feelings with each other. It was called the Sea of Emotion, this little dip in the field, in the sports fields that were on the school grounds. I got the idea to write this song because I was thinking, well, if Steve and I are going to do a record, I'm going to need a theme. I'm going to need an emotional theme. I don't want to think about the record company coming up with ideas about what we might do and that kind of thing. So I thought, what is going to inspire us? What is going to be a true, honest emotion that can drive the rest of the record? And so for some reason, I thought of that, because that was something that we shared when we were that young.
Wow.
And so that's got the ball rolling. We got the song. We got three of them now, actually, part one, part two, part three. Part one has got this crazy video by ZZ that sort of pokes fun at our 70s, early 70s selves. with a great cast of characters, all ZZ's friends, a lot of kids I've known since they were little kids too. So that's really great. And we were on this tour. We'll go to, when's the last date? May 16th, 12th, something like that. It's fantastic, this tour. It's just been so much fun. As Steve just said, we get to play and it's sort of like, now we've got an audience, but it's like we're sitting back to back in the backyard.
Yeah, it is. And it's so great the way it all came about. I mean, we've had so many wonderful years of doing little projects, sometimes contributing to other artists, sometimes G3 record, all this stuff. But I think instinctually we knew one day we gotta, you know, get to just the two of
just
us
the two of you.
And kind of bring our brains together. And it started out very simply as, hey, let's do a tour together in the conventional kind of almost G2 way, you know, where it's like I come out for an hour, Joe comes out for an hour, and then we do the jams. And then it turned into, well, you know, wouldn't it be nice to have some new material? And it seemed like no sooner did that come up than I opened my email and I got these two beautiful tracks from Joe, you know, and that was the Sea of Emotion part one and two. And so I thought, okay, game on, you know. And I just want to tell you this one little story about part three. When I would go to lessons with Joe, and I was so fascinated with the recording process and the whole idea of a sound-on-sound tape recorder, and he had one, and it was there in his bedroom every day, and I just look at it, you know, along with those custom amps with the foam. So funny, the curly cords, everything.
I remember those.
Yeah. And I said, well, you know, what is that? And he goes, well, it's a tape recorder. Let's use it. And I had been taking lessons for about a year and a half by that point. So I was so excited about this. And I guess we've discovered that you showed me this riff, right?
Yeah.
And Joe was experimenting with chords underneath it. And we recorded it, and it's like probably 5-6 minutes long. And you can hear it. It's these two kids. I was like 13, and you must have been 15 or 16 or something. And it was very difficult kind of a riff. Mm-hmm. About 10 years or 15 years after that, Joe sent me the reel-to-reel. At some point, I transferred it to digital. And after I received these two tracks from Joe, I thought, what can we do with this? So I edited a little bit, and I kind of worked on a track, which turned into part three. And excellent. Then we were just like, okay, this, we have to, you know, let's do it. So now yeah. it's just the ideas and the emails and it's just a whole different lease on recording and creating, because for me, I know 30 years of solo record tour, right. maybe this gig over there, this gig over there, but never really had a partner that I could go that deep with musically. It's just such a thrill, you know, and the excitement when we started just exchanging things. It's like, I was always like, well, is this okay? And Joe's like, no, just do yeah. your thing. Do it. I don't, just you do know, it. Do it. And I'm like, really? You know, and so I'm sending stuff and it's fantastic. It's really great. I can't wait for the fans to hear when we're done. We don't even know what it's going to be later, but it's going to be good.
Well, this is a great story. The story of you two growing up together 50 years. I mean, it's really amazing. I really appreciate you guys coming by today. And I really look forward to hearing you guys play.
I love this place is fantastic.
Yeah. Thank you.
To finally actually be in it.
Yeah.
And your millions of viewers don't realize how wonderful it smells here. It smells like guitars and amps and pedals.
It does.
Which, if there was a cologne, I'd wear it. You know what I mean?
There you go. There you go.
I had a cologne called Sam Ash once.
You should sell tickets just so people can...
Yeah, yeah. Well, you do a great work, Rick.
Thank you.
You know, appreciate it's been it. Great to see your whole thing explode, because it's really, it fills a void that's so needed for young guitar players that are so interested.
Yeah, you're championing real music. It's fantastic.
Well, I once again, thank you for being my first guest ever, Steve. My first my interview pleasure. I ever did
wow.
with Steve
in, is that right?
in 2016.
Wow.
So thank you for getting me started off right.
Well, you're a musicologist. It was inevitable because you have real interest. I mean, and the thing is it's, you know, you do interviews, we do interviews all the time, but not so often does somebody really know what you do, what your potential is. They're interested in where you're going. And you're that guy for so many people. So...
appreciate it.
Bravo, I'm the one.
Bravo.
I'll go down in history for being the first one on the Rick Beato show.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank
appreciate
you,
it.
Thank you.